It's a real five.
Yes, and somebody said, look at those, there, towards the village, sort of chops on. So I said, look. And there was this group of Chinese cyclists, and, a cycle or two, or whatever you call it, another assault, but they were mounted on bicycles, and they were pebbling furiously on and down the hill from the village, and of course, they were picked up straight away by the Vickers machine gun, and that was the end of the Chinese cycle platoon. But, they tended, I don't know whether they were drugged or whether it was just that they were so, apparently, possibly of such a simple nature that they, if somebody told them to walk along on their hands, they'd do it, sort of thing. What did they do literally, whatever it was, without whatever they were asked to do without question, I don't know. But earlier they had stood up on the hill, on the crest of the hill, when we were on the reverse slope before we came off A Company's positions, in broad daylight. I mean, they were just sort of standing there and sort of looking as though they were firing into the trenches that we just left. No properly trained Western soldier would do that. I mean, you wouldn't just walk up there, knowing that your enemy was probably just down the other side of the crest. I mean, you crawl up there, and you probably throw a couple of hand grenades first, and then peer cautiously out instead of just walking up there. But this, I don't know. And as I say, the cyclists, seem to adopt the same sort of attitude, in broad daylight. But generally speaking, I didn't see very much of the enemy at close quarters until, of course, I was actually taken prisoner.
How did that happen?
That happened on the Wednesday morning, 25th of April. On Gloucester Hill, as it now is known, Hill 235, which stands up above our memorial. On the Wednesday morning, we were all mixed in all over the place. We were no longer separate companies. We were just, sort of grouped as was best, and sort of reinforced one area from another as the situation developed. I remember that there were three of us in this particular trench on the forward spur leading, or the northward spur, if you like, leading or pointing north into Gloucester Valley, into the actual valley. And the Chinese had come up there. There were three of us in that trench. There was Ken Smith, 2253-0098, Smith 98, with Betsy, his Bren gun. He always used to call his Bren gun Betsy. He'd take the bed with him and look after it. He just used his nickname for it. There was myself. And there was, I can only describe him possibly as a young National Serviceman, some of whom had joined us only a week before the battle started. But I don't know his name. I probably wouldn't recognise him again if I saw him. But, first of all, Ken Smith got out of the trench to move back a bit, further back. He was taken prisoner, but he was unharmed. But then the National Serviceman, the other chap, got out, and he obviously got caught by something, and then I got out, and as I sort of doubled up the side of the hill towards another trench, obviously an incoming mortar ball landed just sort of in front of me, and knocked me flat. I remember looking across to my left and seeing the adjutant, Captain then, Tony Farrell, Captain Farrell Hockley, standing in a trench, if you can call it a trench, because it was barely even up to his knees, and he was standing there in full view of everyone, including the enemy. And he saw, obviously, that I'd been And he gave me an order or an instruction, which I think to this day he probably only did to keep my mind occupied. Not so much to actually deliver the instruction or the request, which was to the effect to ask the colonel to request DF defensive fire, in other words, from the 25 pounders. And of course I just crawled along the ground a little way, found a bivouac tent, crawled into it. It was already occupied by young Brian Gallup, whom the sport company had already been wounded slightly. He broke out my field dressing and applied it in various places where it was necessary. And then, bearing in mind that none of us had had any sleep, this was Wednesday morning, and none of us had had any sleep since we woke up on Sunday morning, 3 days and nights without even shutting our eyes, I just literally crashed straight out, and I don't remember any more until waking up, and all was quiet, except just a murmur of voices outside. There was no noise of battle at all. So I eased myself out of the bivouac tent, and the group of us there, and mostly we were chatting amongst ourselves. And one of them had opened a tin of compo rations, which is composite ration pack, which is really our basic rations in the field. We've got tinned fruit pudding, tinned margarine, tinned bacon, sausages, all those sort of things, and tinned peaches, or sliced peaches. And he just opened this tin of, this chap had just opened this tin of sliced peaches, just handing it to me, when our captors arrived. And our captors were three. One came from behind us, from the southern aspect of Gloucester Hill. In other words, he was, in a sense, he was going the opposite direction in which they had been attacking. He'd obviously come out the back. The other two were coming up the hill from the direction that the original assault had been. One had a Russian burp gun, PPSH, which is a 9mm either a banana magazine, shape magazine, or a drum magazine ammunition. And the other one had an American Garrett M1 30 caliber rifle. I know that I identified that. He's obviously picked that up on the journey southwards from an American unit, which had obviously been defeated in the capture. And they just, well, we just sat there, put our hands above our head, nothing else we could do. The MO was there, and one or two of the other medical staff, and one of the RAMC corporal with A company, Cyril Papworth, who is still around and still in touch with him. So, and he even subsequently ordered a military medal, and I can vouch for that military medal, well and truly. And we sat there and put our hands above our heads, and of course these two Chinese soldiers, three of them, were chilling us onto our feet. Come on, blah, 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 blah. And they were dividing us into two categories. This is my own feeling of the thing. I mean, they didn't tell me they were. This is just my own assessment of the situation. Okay, we'd given them a hard time, and we had given them a hard time. We'd caused them a lot of casualties during that three-day battle. We'd upset the apple cart with their plans to get down into Seoul, certainly by May Day. We'd upset their plans completely, turn them on their head, give them a pretty rough time. And they did not have the best of logistics to support them and supply and the administrative tail. Virtually no administrative tail at all. In fact, they were all really ordinary, all fighting men. So they didn't have the organisation that we would have had. So, in a sense, we were a nuisance to them. But they had been told, obviously we this is something again found out later, they had been told, you know, that they had to practice the lenient policy, they had to tell all, later on as prisoners we were told we'd been duped, we were tools of the wicked capitalists, the Wall Street warmongers, and we had to study and see the light and fight for peace and all the rest of this rigmarole, etc. But they'd obviously, perhaps their lenient policy, perhaps that bit hadn't quite got down to these particular guys. Because they obviously put us into two categories, those who could move, those who were wounded but could be moved, and those who couldn't. And those who couldn't, there was only one answer, and that was the bullet. And I could just about stand up and hold. And Saul Papworth was beside me at the time, and then they obviously, they told him to move, and told us to move, and of course I couldn't, and then there was a shot rang out from behind me, literally from about 8 feet behind me, because this Chinaman, these two were, this one particular one with a rifle was right close up behind me, and the bullet went straight through the leg, in the back, out the front, just over the kneecap, spun me around, knocked me down, and there I was on the ground looking up into the muzzle of the rifle, and waiting for him to take the second pressure, as it were, and fire another shot.
Why do you think he shot you?
Well, because I couldn't, because I was just about a nuisance, pardon the expression, I was just a damn nuisance to him, otherwise it would have meant that he would have had to stop or call upon several other of his comrades to perhaps support, and that sort of thing, as we would have done. Obviously the British would have done, we would have done that. We would willingly have set to and helped one of the enemy back to an aid post. But of course they had no such organisation really. And so we were damn useless. I wasn't the only one, there were two others who were shot and dispatched. One of our sergeants and another chap who were actually shot at that time. Admittedly, the sergeant was very badly wounded and just couldn't, he literally couldn't move, he couldn't even stand up, apparently, and they just simply dispatched him. So I wasn't alone in this, that, as I say, there were several of us who were treated in that way. But I don't feel any great bitterness to it. I mean, I won't tell you what I called that Chinese soldier at the time, but I think if he had been able to understand English, then he would have probably emptied the rest of the magazine into me. But fortunately, he obviously couldn't understand English. And as I say, I gave him a full discharge of barrack room, British Army barrack room language, and I didn't pull my punches.
Why do you think he didn't shoot you again?
Well, I think he couldn't understand me. I mean, he didn't register the fact that I was swearing at him. That didn't register. And I think he probably thought, oh well, he can't go any further. He won't. He can't cause us further trouble. He just left me. Left me to my own devices. So I decided that the only way I would survive would be by my own unaided efforts, because the rest of the party, I was completely on my own, the rest of them had been taken off along the ridge and down the down the hill into the valley, obviously, and I was just literally left to my own devices. I was, the only people around, the only losses around me were the dead ones. So it was obviously down to me if I wanted to survive. I decided I did.
What were your wounds from the mortar?
My wounds from the mortar were the fact that I was then blinded in one eye. And I had various little bits of shrapnel wound in one leg and another parts of the body. Nothing too serious in itself. In fact, if I got medical attention, apart from the eye, which I don't think anything could be done about that, that was shrapnel. I think that if I got medical attention from the first incident, I'd probably be fine. You know, I don't see a problem. I'd probably have been hospitalised for a couple of weeks, a month, and then back to the unit. But of course, with this, that meant that I was at that stage no longer able to walk. I couldn't even stand, let alone walk. So I spent the rest of the day making my way down the hill, down into the valley. That was still separate times. Lost consciousness, whatever you call it. Yes, lost consciousness, I suppose.
You were by yourself?
Yep, absolutely. Completely. Now, whether anybody, while I was lying there unconscious, whether anybody came past, I don't know. Or whether any of the Chinese came past and perhaps pushed me or prodded me, or I don't know. I have no idea. As I say, I lost consciousness several times, and eventually I arrived down at the bottom of the hill, in the valley, where there were then, of course, obviously, where they were gathering people together, those who come from the hill, and those they captured when the rest of them tried to break out down the hill, and of course they were caught and brought back. As I say, the Chinese were literally everywhere. They just occupied the whole area. They were on the high ground. You just didn't stand a chance. And anyway, there were several other wounded people around them. And then happened an incident which literally made my day. This Chinaman had been looting the cook's three-ton Bedford. And he had found a tin of Collins mustard. Rectangular tins, and he also yellow label, etc. He found it, and he had what's called a GI spoon, which is an American dessert spoon, and it's an American Army issue, and it's got a sort of little hole in the in the handle where you can sort of hang the thing up. Anyway, it's a dessert spoon size, and I sat there. And this is absolutely true. I'm saying exactly what happened. I sat there, and I watched him. He took the lid off that tin, dug the spoon into it. Didn't know what the hell it was, obviously. No idea. I mean, it could have been caster sugar, could have been flour, could have been anything. It was just a yellow powder. So obviously his primitive mind got the better of it, his curiosity. Dumped the spoon in, put it in his mouth, dropped the spoon, put his hand up to his mouth, dropped the tin, and he just took off. I didn't see where he ended up, but he just ran for his life. And really, that literally made my day. I thought, serves you right, it does. Shouldn't be so inquisitive. Anyway, that little incident apart. Then eventually we were shoved into the back of one of our ambulances by the Chinese and taken down the road to the village of Chok Song, where we were pushed out of there rather unceremoniously and into this Korean lean-to, sort of corrugated shed, lean-to thing, like a store shed. Three or four of us were quartered there for the night, and we stayed there that night and the next day. And the next evening we were moved on across the river and moved to another village, and there we met up with several other people in Segmento Waters, for example. He joined us at that stage. George Madgwick, Brian Gallup, myself, Terry Waters, I think there are any other names at the time. Oh yes, Lieutenant Perrins, Tony Perrins, who was junior officer with the Royal Fusiliers. were moved from that bridge one night. They came and collected us in one of their own vehicles, one of their own open vehicles, open trucks. And all right, we were, you know, we were not fed for the first week or so, but then they started feeding us sort of twice a day, so early in the morning, late at night, and that was in the evening, and that was just boiled rice and nothing else, just simply boiled rice. So, and that was after about the first week. By which time, of course, although we were constipated for the first couple of days, then I'm afraid the floodgates opened. From then on, we all had first of all diarrhea, and then obviously became dysentery, as our sort of toilet conditions worsened, as it were. But we're taken in this lorry this one night, rather, because they used to travel at night. But before that, I've got to describe another incident before that. We were taken from one village to another, again at night, just north of the engine, so we were still in the battle zone, in a sense, still right in the battle zone, the general battle zone. And we were, and the Chinese came along, and they put us on stretchers. Now, the Chinese stretcher party, that consists of six men and a stretcher. Now, the way they worked it was that four would carry the stretcher, and two would trot along behind. At intervals, the two trotting behind would take over the two at the back, the two at the back would take over the two at the front, the two at the front would drop back. And they'd rotate it like this as they went across country. They literally, they didn't stick to the paths of the roads, they just went up and over the paddy fields, over the paddy bounds, uphill, down, down, you know, and just more or less straight across country, which is quite an experience, particularly when an American aircraft came over and dropped magnesium flare, which lights the whole place up by the day. You can see to read the smallest print in the newspaper by it, you know, you really can. And of course, our Chinese friends could simply drop the stretcher on the track and disappeared into the scrub quick. And then of course came back eventually and picked us up and took us on. But that journey killed George Magnet, I'm afraid. He had a stomach wound, and no matter what we did, we were unable to keep the water bottle. We had a water bottle with us from somehow or other, and no matter what we did, we couldn't hide it from him. And so eventually, but as I say, this journey probably just killed him. And then we had young Scoynes, Chuckle Scoynes. He had been wounded by American air attack after he was taken prisoner. He lived for about 10 days, having been hit by a 50 caliber bullet. He lived for about a week or 10 days, and then he died. And then we lost several others at various stages along the way. We spent quite a long time in one village, strangely enough, about 10 miles north of Pyongyang. Now, I don't think it was the exact spot where we had been when we had been been withdrawing previous December, but it wasn't very far from it. And we were in one village on one side on the right hand side of the road. This is looking going more on the eastern side of the road, if you like, for a few weeks, and then during that time, we were visited by a Chinese doctor, and he said to us, he went round through half a dozen of us, you know, and he was deciding who was fit to travel and who wasn't. And I had, well, a gangrenous finger, I suppose you could say. I don't know why I've still got them, but I had. Still a bit touchy even now, 40 years later. But it had a bit of a bandage around it. And he looked at me and said, "Well, Wuxing, can't, you see. Well, no." I said, "What do you mean, no?" I said, "I'm fit to travel." "Well, Wuxing, you see, and you know, just got quite cross with me." So I thought, "Oh, well, you know, Then those who were fit enough to, or described fit enough to travel, were separated. They were taken off on a Chinese mule cart. And then they were brought back. And then the next day, the same thing was processed and repeated. And we discovered afterwards that they were then handed over to the tender mercies of the North Koreans. For some reason, I cannot explain why the Chinese handed, separated our group and handed some of them to the North Koreans. There must have been a reason for it, perhaps some internal administrative reason, perhaps a political reason, I don't know. I can only say that, obviously, that was what was done, and that most of the people who were thus handed over did not survive.
Were the North Koreans worse than the Chinese?
Yes. 10,000 times worse. If we had been fighting a North Korean unit, I don't suppose any of us would have survived. We're not within the handful. It would have been, in a sense, rather like the Japs. Jap situation. That just doesn't bear thinking about. Chinese are no angels. I mean, they were no angels. You've probably heard me recount. But I'm glad we were taken by them and not the North Koreans.
Why do you think the North Koreans were worse?
Because I think that, well, put it this way, I think the Chinese were as they were because they had decided that they would make a political issue of this. They would use the indoctrination, political indoctrination. This had never been tried before in any all previous campaigns. In the Second World War, if you've been taken prisoner by your adversary, generally speaking, there were exceptions, but generally speaking, that was the end of it for you. You then went into a prison of war camp, and perhaps the Red Cross visited, although not in the case of Jeppy, at least I know, it's an exception. But generally speaking, if you were taken by the Germans or the Italians, you ended up in a prison of war camp, and Red Cross passes, and so forth. But this political indoctrination never been tried before. Something completely new. Something for which none of us were really prepared in any shape or form. It came to us completely out of the blue. And I think really that is the reason why so many of us survived. Because we were fighting the Chinese, and the Chinese had this thought about trying to convert us to their way of thinking, to the communist way of thinking. And therefore they had this, they called it the Meiden policy. We do not kill the prisoners, we do not shoot prisoners. Well, okay, fair enough. Mistakes in every mistakes in every organization, I suppose. But I think that's the way I put it, that the Chinese, not why were the North Koreans worse. I think the Chinese were the lesser of two evils because they had this idea that they could convert us all to communism.
Whereas the North Koreans didn't.